Well, good morning once again, folks. Today is March 13th, Wednesday, and this is the Great Niagara County History Show. We've had a slight change of plans. Becky Pittler couldn't make it today, so we are joined in studio with our very own Melissa Dunlop and the first time in forever, Anne Marie Lindenberry is with us today. Good morning, ladies. How are you? Happy, happy, happy. So good to see you, ladies. It's been so long since I've seen you, Anne Marie. I almost forgot what you look like.
Well, that's okay. So,
my goodness.
Well, we're happy to be here.
Well,
we have a lot going on that we want to tell you about.
Oh, please. So we're going to start out with some events, maybe?
Yes.
Let's do.
Okay. Well, now that we were speaking about Anne Marie, she has completed a new book, The Third Niagara Discoveries, Volume 3. And it's all her articles that she writes for the Union Sun and Journal, and they're on varied subjects and always interesting. So she is going to be having a book signing on March 23rd. It'll be from 1:30 to 3, right at the Historical Society, 215 Niagara Street. And if somebody wants to call to ask any questions, it's 716-434-7433. But tomorrow, we have a program at 2 o'clock, and it is presented by Terry Abrams, the curator, and he's going to talk about historic photographers of Lockport. Terry, as the curator, has been collecting photographs from local photographers, and there are a lot more than you really realize. And so he's going to talk about the different types of photographs and the history of the photographers, and it will be a PowerPoint, I'm sure. So that'll be really interesting, and that's tomorrow at 215 Niagara Street at 2 o'clock. And also on April, I know we're kind of jumping ahead a little, Thursday, April 25th at 2 is going to be Jim Bowles, and he's going to talk about voids of Lockport and the hidden caves and secret passages under Lockport. Now, these are the natural caves that they used to be able to enter from Cave Street. These are not the man-made caves that had the boat ride or anything else in it. So, and Jim Bowles is a longtime historian, and it will be a really good program also. So tomorrow at 2, we have Terry Abrams, and he's doing Historic Photographers of Lockport. And then Anne Marie on March 23rd is doing her book signing on her new book, Niagara Discoveries, Volume 3. So obviously there's a Volume 1 and 2. If you've missed any of them, they're all here. So that's the two things. We are looking still for applications for our interns. We are going to close the application process next Monday. So people still have over the weekend. So it is for college students. These are really good jobs, well-paying. They're full-time jobs from mid-May until early August. And we're looking for an assistant for Terry Abrams in the curatorial office, and also a museum assistant to help all around in the different facets around the museum. They are paid internships, and the applications are available. If somebody wants to get one, they can send an inquiry to info@niagarahistory.org. So if you have a grandchild or know of somebody that's college age that's still looking for a summer job or hasn't started looking, unfortunately we're getting down to the deadline because we usually interview over Easter, and of course Easter is early this year, because we need to get everything lined up. And this is part of the Grigg Lewis Workership Program. It's a grant program from the Grigg Lewis. It's for Eastern Niagara students. So it does unfortunately exclude Niagara Falls and North Tonawanda, but that's their criteria. And these jobs are interesting because you're learning how a nonprofit works. It's really hands-on. So we're hoping that somebody will apply to info@niagarahistory.org. Okay. Today we're going to talk about St. Patrick's Day. and the Irish in Lockport. So we have a lot of interesting things. We have some facts, and Anne-Marie has information about some prominent people from Niagara County. So here we go.
Okay, well, we all know the story of the Irish and the Erie Canal here in Lockport. We're not going to talk so much about that today, but I would like to read a quote that was made back in the time of the Erie Canal. And it said that this was done by made by a journalist in New York City. And he said, "There are many different kinds of power working the fabric of the Republic today." So this would have been in the 1820s. "There is water power, steam power, and Irish power, and the last works the hardest of all." And so even since the beginning in the 1820s, when the Irish were here in Lockport working on the Erie Canal, and then after the canal was done, many of them did leave to go on to other canal projects throughout the United States, but many of them did stay here in Lockport, and they established eventually in the 1830s St. John's Parish. And then their descendants actually became some of the more well-known people here in Lockport, and we're going to talk about a few of them right now. Now, probably the most famous Lockport connection that people know about would be the composer and singer Chauncey Olcott. Now, he was not born in Lockport, but his grandparents, his mother's parents, were from Lockport. And he was born in 1860 in Buffalo. His name was John Chancellor Olcott, but he was always known as Chauncey. His father was actually a Scotch-Irish Presbyterian, and his mother was an Irish Catholic. And as I said, her parents, they were the Doyles, and they were here. They lived here in Lockport. And they think that they met because her father worked on the Erie Canal and her future husband had a canal boat. So they would come through here, and that's how they met. But when Chauncey was a young boy, he would spend the summers with his grandparents here in Lockport. And at a very young age, they discovered that he had a very good singing voice. And so he would actually be taken to some of the fire halls and even some of the saloons in Lockport, and he would be put up on a table, and he would be first, he learned, obviously, the Irish songs, and then he would be singing the Irish songs. So he was very popular here in Lockport as a young boy. But when he was about 10 years old, his grandfather was killed in a canal accident, an accident on the canal. He actually fell into the canal and drowned. And the family moved to his grandmother, and they all moved to Buffalo. But after that, as Chauncey got older, and he became famous as both a singer and a songwriter, and he composed such St. Patrick's Day standards as "When Irish Eyes Are Smiling," my "Wild Irish Rose," "Mother McCree." He would always come back to Lockport. Every year, he would do a concert at the Hodge Opera House in Lockport. And so he never forgot those Lockport roots. And he died, actually, ironically, he died on St. Patrick's Day in 1932. And he's actually buried in New York City. But again, he never forgot those days that he spent here in Lockport as a young boy. And he also always considered Lockport as one of his homes. Okay. Did you want to interject something, Melissa?
Well, you do somebody else, and then I'll
okay. All right. The other person that gained quite a bit of notoriety. Can't talk this morning. Sorry about that. At probably about the same time that Chauncey Olcott was also singing and composing songs was a woman named Mary Ellen Powers. And Mary Ellen Powers was actually born on Grand Street, 270 Grand Street. The house is still standing. And she was born into a family of particularly on her father's side, of very tall people. Her father was 6'8". She had brothers that were around that same height. But even as a child, Mary Ellen surpassed even her brothers in height. And when she was in third grade, she was already 5'10". And by the time she was in high school, she was 6'10". And so at that point, she began performing and as sort of almost like a sideshow attraction for several circuses in the United States, and eventually ended up with Barnum and Bailey Circus, and she was billed as the tallest woman in the world. Her stage name was Leah May. And she, again, traveled the world with Barnum and Bailey. She was a favorite with people visiting the circus, but also with the other circus performers. She became very good friends with the woman who was the tiniest woman in the world. And Mary Ellen would make her own clothing. Obviously, she couldn't find clothing that would fit her. She also made clothing for the tiniest woman in the world because she couldn't find clothing to fit her either. And so she did this for a number of years, but then she, in 1911, she married Morris Stapleton, who was also from Lockport, and at that point she retired from the circus, and they ended up living on West Jackson Street. He had a farm on West Jackson Street. He was also about 5'8", so he was a little, I'm sorry, 6'8", sorry. He was a little shorter than she was. Now, they lived there until she died in October of 1933, and she was 65 years old when she died. She was buried in St. Patrick's. And again, as I mentioned, she never had any children, so she was only survived by her husband and one brother. But the house that she grew up on Grand Street, is still standing. And I also believe that the farmhouse on West Jackson Street is also still standing. So,
and she also used to wear a hat to make her look taller.
Yes. We have photographs of her at the museum. She's very impressive.
A very pretty lady.
Yes.
So when I was doing some research today, I was surprised to find out that there's St. Patrick's Day parades around the world. And on the island of Montserrat in the British West Indies, St. Patrick's Day is a public holiday that's celebrated with a week-long festival and parade. Now, that was a surprise to me. The island was colonized by Irish Catholics in the 17th century, and early generations of European settlers were Irish. Nicknamed the Emerald Isle of the Caribbean, Montserrat's official passport stamp is a green shamrock. See, you learn something new every day. Among the many other locations where St. Paddy's Day is now observed is the Canadian city of Montreal. It's the site of a large annual parade that's been held there continuously since 1824. There's been a parade in Tokyo, Japan since 1992. That was a little surprising. And one in Oslo, Norway since 2000. Auckland, New Zealand has had a parade and a festival since 1995. People there can get a jump on the majority of the planet when it comes to celebrating St. Patrick's Day, as Auckland is 13 hours ahead of Dublin and 17 hours ahead of New York City. So they're actually, the biggest parade here, we'll talk about it later, is in Boston. But I thought that was really interesting that there's St. Patrick's Day parades all around the world.
Oh. All right, another woman that had Irish ties to Lockport was Mary McCauley. And Mary McCauley was actually born in Leroy, but Mary McCauley, at a young age, got a job as a telegrapher, someone who sends telegraphs back and forth. She started out working for Western Union, but they went on strike, and she went on strike with them, and she lost her job. And then she began to work for the United Press Association. And it was at that point that she began working here in Lockport in 1902. She began working for the Lockport Union Sun and Journal. Well, it eventually became the Lockport Union Sun and Journal. And so she actually stayed in Lockport for 25 years. And during that time, she became the first woman to be the, she was the treasurer for the telegraphers union. It was based in Buffalo. But she was also the second, Lockport was the second telegraph line to be established in the United States, by the way. I should have mentioned that earlier, in 1846. The first one was from Washington to Baltimore. The second one was from Lockport to Buffalo. So Lockport had a very early history of telegraphy, the telegraph line. She lived in various locations in the city when she lived here. She lived at 175 Chestnut, 66 Pine, and 147 Washburn Street. She worshipped at St. John's or at St. Patrick's, depending on where she was living. And while she was here in Lockport, she would either send or receive 15,000 words a day, which I thought was pretty impressive. And there weren't a lot of women telegraphers at that time. And president of the United Press Association wrote that of the women telegraphers, I have known but a few that have had the endurance of men. The notable exceptions have been Mary J. McCauley and a few others he named, all in the service of the United Press, and they did a man's job each. And I am also proud that they also were paid men's salaries, which was very unusual at that time, that women were paid the same salaries as men. So she, again, stayed in Lockport for 25 years, and she retired in 1927, and she moved back to Leroy, where she was originally from. She died in 1944. She had never married, and she had no heirs, so she left her estate to St. Patrick's Catholic Church in Leroy. And ironically, my daughter lived in a house right next to St. Patrick's Church in Leroy for a little while, so I know exactly where that church is. So, but so again, another woman or person of Irish descent that had a connection to Lockport.
Okay. All right, so I tried to find out more history. We'll do St. Patrick's after. More history about how leprechauns became so popular that they're even on Lucky Charms, and you can get your Lucky
Charms. They're magically delicious,
right? With your four-leaf clovers this month. And sometimes they're just all green and clovers during March. But leprechauns are an Irish folklore. They're a fairy in the form of a tiny man, often with a crooked hat and a leather apron. Solitary by nature, it is said to live in remote places and to make shoes and brogues. And brogues are, I thought, shoes, but they're boots.
They're more like boots. Yeah, maiden name is Brogan. Yeah. So, yes. Yeah, boots.
Okay. So the sound of his hammering betrays his presence. He possesses a hidden crock of gold. If captured and threatened with bodily violence, he might, if his captor keeps his eye on him, reveal its hiding place. But usually the captor is tricked into glancing away, and the fairy vanishes. The word derives ultimately from Old Irish lucarpan, or little body. So it's kind of interesting, but my children are older now. Unfortunately, you know, I don't know how they got so old, because I'm only 39. But anyway, they keep aging. But now kids make leprechaun traps.
Yeah, we did that with Aaron, so yeah.
Because my grandchildren make leprechaun traps so that they're sure that they're going to find a leprechaun and that they can get him to give the gold. So we'll see what happens.
I just have to mention, my husband just told me he's reading a new mystery, murder mystery, where the leprechaun is the murderer. So
oh, you never know.
I know.
So, and of course, St. Patrick's Day is March 17th, and it is celebrated in Lockport. I know there's a particular restaurant that has a big event and a tent outside and Irish dancers and everything, and it's celebrated with parades. And I know that Anne Marie has gone to the one in Buffalo many times.
Yeah, I've marched in it, but it's been a while since I've done that. So.
Is that the Seamus restaurant we're referring to? Yeah, we can say that on the air.
Well, I didn't know if they were one of your sponsors, but yes.
They most assuredly are. And even if they weren't, for St. Patrick's Day, we would let that slide. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to The Great History Show here on WLVL 1340 AM, streaming worldwide at WLVL.com. If you'd like to join the conversation, we would love it. 433-1433. You can ask Anne Marie Lineberry or Melissa Dunlop any of your questions about the history of LaPorte, or join in with a memory, perhaps, of all the great things you're talking about. What was your favorite St. Patrick's Day memory that you can say on AM radio?
I remember we had a neighbor, and she took old spaghetti out of her refrigerator, and she dyed it green, and she brought it over. But she was a real practical joker anyway.
Oh, that's funny.
I can remember her. It was like stiff.
Yeah. Oh, so did she really need the dye? That's the question.
You're saying about the St. Patrick's Day memories that you remember. There's probably a lot of people that can't remember their St. Patrick's Day memories.
You know, the details are a little fuzzy for a few of mine. I know that.
Yeah, me too.
1990s.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Okay, so another person that is well known to LaPorte is Jimmy Duffy. And Jimmy Duffy, of course, was a very well known boxer, not only here in LaPorte, but all over the United States. He was born in LaPorte on June 12th, 1889, at 383 Gooding Street. And he was primarily raised by his grandparents. He attended St. Patrick's School. And when he was a teenager, he began playing baseball and training to be a boxer at the North End Club. And so about the time that he was 17, he had his first boxing match. It was at the Crow Building on Lock Street, and he won that match. And he decided at that point that he could make a living out of being a professional boxer. So starting in 1908, he embarked on a 13-year career as a boxer. He fought 8 matches in LaPorte, but most of the fights took place in Buffalo or other cities around the country. He fought at the old Broadway Auditorium in Buffalo, which is now the NFTA Bus Barn, and also at the Elmwood Music Hall, which no longer exists. These were very popular matches. Thousands of people would come to see him. Out of the 169 bouts that he fought, he only lost 21. So that was a really good record. And he boxed a lot of the most well-known boxers at that time with names like Packy McFarlane, Knockout Brown, Jack Britton, Freddie Welsh, Knockout Brennan, and many others. But unfortunately for Duffy, none of these matches were title fights, even though many of his opponents were title holders. And so the purses for these matches were not as large as they would have been for title fights. But Duffy was able to make a living out of the fights that he did win. He was immensely popular in LaPorte in Western New York, and locally he was known as the Duke of LaPorte. And he was welcomed by cheering crowds whenever he returned to the city. He did serve in World War I, and then after that, he was involved in a car accident, which unfortunately he injured his leg, and that sort of curtailed his boxing career for a time. But in 1921, he decided to retire from boxing, and it was at that point that he was appointed a Niagara County Sheriff's Deputy, and he served in that capacity until 1949, so 27 years, but unfortunately he had a fall in 1949, which forced him to retire, and he really never recovered fully from that fall, and he died on April 30th, 1960, and he is buried in St. Patrick's Cemetery. But again, he was someone that was very well known and very well loved in LaPorte, someone of Irish descent from the city.
Okay, so I looked up a couple things about St. Patrick, and there was one from Time Magazine It said St. Patrick was a Roman citizen because Britain and Roman was Roman then, and he was enslaved and taken to Ireland. So he actually was born in Britain, which I was surprised. He was actually... Okay, I'm going to find this other one. He actually was held for 6 years. They're not sure whether he escaped. He was a shepherd. They put him out as a shepherd, so he was all by himself, which would make it easier to escape, I would think. But eventually he went back to England. But during the time that he was in captivity is when he really became religious and decided that he really wanted to make a change and spread Christianity to other people. So once he became back to England, he decided that he would go back to Ireland and he would help to Christianize the country. So when he did that, he started to get other people to... Let's see. I should read a different one because that one is kind of choppy. All right. So he was in County Mayo is where he was being held. It was believed that he was held and then just escaped to the Irish coast. He reported the experience of revelation. An angel in a dream tells him to return to Ireland as a missionary. Soon after, Patrick began religious training, a course of study that lasted more than 15 years. Wow, that's a long study. And his ordination... After his ordination as a priest, he was sent to Ireland with a dual mission, to minister to Christians already living in Ireland and to begin to convert the Irish. Interesting, this mission contradicts the widely held notion that Patrick introduced Christianity to Ireland, because there were already Christians there. He was familiar with the Irish language and culture, and he chose to incorporate traditional rituals into his lessons of Christianity instead of attempting to eradicate native Irish beliefs. For instance, he used bonfires to celebrate Easter, since the Irish are used to honoring their gods with fire. He also superimposed a sun, a powerful Irish symbol, onto the Christian cross to create what is now a Celtic cross, so that veneration of the symbol would seem more natural to the Irish. Although there were a small number of Christians on the island when Patrick arrived, most Irish practiced a nature-based pagan religion. The Irish culture centered around a rich tradition of oral legend and myth. When this is considered, it's no surprise that the story of Patrick's life became exaggerated over the centuries, spinning exciting tales to remember history has always been part of the Irish way of life. He was known as the patron saint of Ireland, but Patrick was never actually canonized by the Catholic Church. Simply, it was due to the era he lived in. During the first millennium, there was no formal canonization process in the Catholic Church. So it was because of his popularity that he became a saint. He's one of the most widely known figures, but the holiday is held on the day of his death, which is kind of surprising, that bears his name, and some of his life still remains a mystery. Many of the stories associated with St. Patrick, including the famous account of him banishing all the snakes from Ireland, are false, but they're the products of hundreds of years of exaggerated storytelling. So... And it was at the age of 16 that he was taken prisoner by a group of Irish raiders who were attacking his family's estate. So that's how he ended up in Ireland and had the 6 years of captivity. So that's a little bit about St. Patrick.
Okay, we're going to talk about another sports figure from Lockport, and his name was Martin Fenton Whalen. He was more popularly known as Finn or Darb Whalen. He actually was the father of the local artist Joe Whalen, but he was actually known for baseball. In fact, there were a number of people from Lockport at this time period who were also known for their baseball skills. Another one was Leo Dolan, right?
Yeah.
The VFW post was named for. He was also a baseball player, and there were a few others. But Darb Whalen was born in January 1st, 1890, and he began his baseball career when he was 18 years old. And he was considered a professional baseball player. He played in the Class D Empire State League. He played with teams in Lyons, New York, And they traveled not only in New York State, but they also traveled to Ohio, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Alabama, Connecticut. So, and then he also played for another team in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And that was a couple of years later. So that would have been around 1910. And they that club actually won the pennant that year. So he usually played second or third base or shortstop. Shortstop was his favorite, he said. He said one game he grabbed the ball and threw it to first. However, he overthrew the ball and hit a man in the stands, knocking his derby off. And the man yelled out, "Who hired you to play ball?" And Darb, with his quick wit, fired back and said, "Stetson." So in 1917, he joined the Army and was stationed in Fort Johnson, Florida. He also played down while he was in the service. He played down there. But after his time in the service, it says he was transferred from the professional league to the Hot Stove League, which was the sports banquet circuit. And he was known as one of the best after-dinner speakers because of his wit and his humor. He was, again, well-known in Lockport, very well-liked in Lockport, spent the rest of his life in Lockport. So after he retired from baseball, he also worked as a mail carrier until he retired in 1950. And he also worked 5 years at Bell Aircraft Corporation before retiring from that in 1955. And then the rest of his time, he split between Lockport and wintering in Florida. He passed away on November 14th, 1973. And he is buried in St. Patrick's Cemetery. So that was the life of another sports figure here in Lockport that's very well known, Darb Whalen. You want me to do another one? Okay. All right. Another, these were actually three men who had the last name of Fitzgeralds, and they were the Dr. Fitzgeralds. And I know a lot of people still remember the last of the three Dr. Fitzgeralds. The first Dr. Fitzgerald was he was known as Dr. R.R.B. His name was Robert Roland Braden Fitzgerald, and he was born in 1881, and he practiced, I haven't reviewed this recently, but he took over a practice from another doctor in 1908, and then he practiced until his death in 1956. He practiced here in Lockport all of those years. In fact, he built the Medical Arts Building at 136 Walnut Street. And that building is still there, but it is being used for something else now.
It's a nerd game store.
Oh, okay. It's a nerd game store.
My kids go there.
But it was originally the Medical Arts Building, which was built by Dr. R.R.B. Fitzgerald. Now, he had two sons. He had Dudley B. Fitzgerald, and he was born in Lockport in 1910, and he graduated from medical school in 1936, and then he had a practice here in Lockport for a few years, but then in 1939, he joined his father's practice, but then he ended up in World War II in the Pacific, and then he came back, and he served with his father until his father's death in 1956. And then at that point, he was named chief of surgery at Lockport Memorial Hospital. He died rather suddenly of a heart attack in 1971 at the age of 61. The younger brother, H. Braden Fitzgerald, he was born in 1912. And he also graduated from the Rochester Medical School. He did his internship at Strong Memorial, just as his brother had done. And he joined his father's practice as well. But again, he also served in World War II. They both served in the Pacific. And when he returned, he also joined his father's practice and continued his father's practice. And he continued his practice. He became the chief of staff at both the Lockport Memorial and Mount View Hospitals. He actually continued to make house calls until his retirement in 1995. And he was retired for about 10 years, but continued to reside in Lockport until his death in 2005 at the age of 95. And he died in the same house that he was born in, yeah, which is kind of unusual.
And we do have that exhibit at the museum. Actually, the sons use their father's equipment, so it dates back to RRB, and we have pictures of when it was their dad's office, and pretty much that's what we have.
Yeah.
There was another set of three doctors, a father and two sons, and that was the Crosby family.
Yes.
So it was
interesting. They were Irish too. So.
Yeah, but it really interesting that there were two fathers with two sons, and they all became doctors.
And they were around the same time period.
Yes. And the Crosbys, they had that beautiful yellow house that's now the parking lot of
Taylor and Reynolds.
Taylor and Reynolds, yeah. But it burned down, in the early 90s, and then it was there for a couple of years before it was demolished. But, it's interesting that you had two sets, and I know how well-liked Braden Fitzgerald was. I mean, people really liked him, and they have the signs in the exhibit telling when his home office was and that he would go out and do the house calls. And also, when we were interviewing people for that exhibit, because it was put in, in the real early 2000s, that how handsome Dudley was. Several of the women mentioned about he was really handsome. So it was kind of interesting. All right. So looking back at St. Patrick's Day, the first St. Patrick's Day New York City parade was in 1762. And it wasn't until 1798, the year of the Irish Rebellion, that the color green became officially associated with the day. Previously to that, it was blue, because blue was the royal color. But after that, and Britain was using red, so that's why it became green.
Yeah.
They were going to differentiate.
Yeah.
All right. The wearing of the green became a song during the rebellion, and it was cementing.
Sing it, but I won't.
They pay me not to sing. So I couldn't even sing with the radio in the car with my kids. During the rebellion, it cemented the color's relevance in Irish history. As for the green beer, that's an even later addition. In fact, it wasn't until the late 20th century that Ireland repealed a law that initially kept everything, pubs included, shut down for the day. Since then, thanks to a marketing push from Budweiser in the 1980s, downing beer has become a common way to celebrate, regardless of how closely it's tied to the actual meaning of St. Patrick himself. And of course, they dye the river in Chicago.
Yeah.
And I mean, all sorts of things happen for St. Patrick's Day, but it's a fun holiday, and it does make people remember St. Patrick.
Yes.
Absolutely. So. Well, you guys are just a virtual wealth of knowledge here. I'm going to let you catch your breath by doing a 10-second station identification for you here, and then we'll get right back to it.
Okay.
Doug Steffen here, host of the Good Day Radio program. You're listening to Niagara County's information station, WLBL Lockport.
All right, easy peasy. Folks, you're listening to the History Show here on WLVL with Melissa Dunlap and Anne-Marie Lineberry. And we're talking about all things history in Lockport, and of course now it's St. Patrick's Day. So you still have plenty of time if you would like to call and join in on the conversation, 433-1433. We would love to hear from you this morning. Okay, ladies, back to your green Budweiser.
I would think that somebody has some good St. Patrick's Day story.
Yeah. Well, it's funny you talk about green Budweiser. It reminds me of the frogs.
Yes. Those ads were great.
Remember the three frogs?
I do. During the Super Bowl, they did have those? Yes.
That's back when Super Bowl commercials were really fun.
Yes, they were.
Now they're just dumb.
Well, they did bring the Clydesdales back for one ad this year.
Yeah. That's good. I love those horses. They're beautiful.
I know. One thing I did fail to mention about St. Patrick was that he used the shamrock to explain the Trinity to people, that it was a good way for them to understand it.
That. Yes. Yes. Okay, a couple more people. One of the people, again, he wasn't originally from Lockport, but came to Lockport as a young man, was Colonel Dudley Donnelly, and he was a Civil War hero. But he was born in Cortland, New York, Cortland County, I should say. He was born in Homer, New York, the same place where Dave Marmon was born.
Yes, Dave was from Homer.
Yep. Yes, good neighbor Dave was from Homer, New York, and so was Dudley Donnelly, and that's in Cortland. And Cortland County, I should say. He was born there in 1826. He actually came to Lockport as a young man to study law. So he was basically a lawyer. He was also, in some of the census, he was mentioned as a magistrate. So he had a law practice here in Lockport. But when the Civil War broke out, he was one of the first people to join when William Wirt Bush established the 28th Infantry Volunteer Regiment from Lockport. And so Colonel Donnelly had been a colonel in the militia here in Lockport. So when he joined, he kept his rank as colonel in the 28th as well. And the 28th, this was established in 1861, and they were involved in several of the battles. They were involved with the Battle at Winchester. They were involved at Cedar Mountain, and that is where, unfortunately, Colonel Dudley was shot and killed on August 9th, 1862, at the Battle of Cedar Mountain. And his body was returned back to Lockport, and later in the month of August, there was a very somber funeral held for him. The buildings were draped in black here in Lockport, and there was a procession he was actually, even though he was Irish, he was not Catholic, he was Episcopalian, but from Grace Episcopal Church, and all the way the procession marched from, or walked, I should say, from Grace Episcopal all the way to Cold Spring Cemetery, where he was buried. But he was very well respected, both as a man and as a military leader, and they said that after his death, the men that were left in the regiment, because they did lose a lot of men in the 28th during that battle, but those who were left actually wept when they heard that Colonel Donnelly had been killed in action. So another well-known, very respected person from Lockport of Irish descent was Colonel Dudley Donnelly.
They also named one of the training camps for him.
Yes.
Yeah. So there is something that does memorialize him.
There's also Donnelly Point at Outwater Park.
Right.
Recently read an article, well, probably within the last couple of years, that had been overgrown and that they had wished that it would be, cleaned up a bit. So I don't know if that ever happened or not.
I don't either.
Yeah. So another war hero that a lot of people know about is Frank Gaffney. And Frank Gaffney was born, he was born in Niagara Falls. And he also worked at a paper mill in Niagara Falls. And in April of 1917, he joined the U.S. Army to fight in World War I. And this is he ended up getting the Medal of Honor. And I'm trying to read this here. But he was among the first men. One of the first men to be killed in World War I was a man named Private Joseph O'Hearn. And then, of course, we mentioned Leo Dolan earlier in the program, being associated with baseball. Another man was Matthew Lanigan. He was also killed. But Frank Gaffney, I'm sorry, I'm getting off track here. I'm sorry, Melissa. Do you have anything else to say? Because I'm getting kind of, I've gotten.
I did want to something that's not doesn't have anything to do with St. Patrick's Day, but we have started to rebrand ourselves as the Niagara History Center. So we're still the Niagara County Historical Society and always will be, but we're doing business as the Niagara History Center. So we have developed a new logo, and it's still a legal name. So if somebody wrote a check to the Niagara History Center, that could be cashed. But we're trying to make it easier for people to understand that we are a complex, because for those of you that might not be aware, we actually have 7 buildings. We have 5 buildings at 215 Niagara Street. We have the Colonel William Bond House, which is on the National Register. It's an 1824 building, and of course that was constructed before the opening of the Erie Canal, and it was the first red brick building in Lockport. And we also have the Erie Canal Discovery Center down by the locks. So we do have 3 different locations, and in order to make it so that people understand, because I had people that stopped me, and I worked from 1990 into 2023. So people that would stop me and say, gosh, you should go to that Erie Canal Discovery Center. And it surprised me that people didn't associate us with the Discovery Center. So in order to make it one big complex, that's why we decided to be the Niagara History Center. And so that incorporates all 3 locations. And I know that Becky has been a volunteer at the Colonel Bond House since the age of 15. So she is very vested in seeing that the Colonel Bond House is well known. But it's interesting, and I know it's confusing to some people that they think, you know, we've dropped the name Niagara County Historical Society. But that is our IRS identification and our official, we're under a membership corporation is when we were originally started in 1947, although the Historical Society started in 1921, but it wasn't incorporated until 1947. So last year is when we became the Niagara History Center. So if you see something that says Niagara History Center, it's still us. It's just got a different logo, which says Niagara History Center. And we're just trying to streamline things. Now you're probably more confused than ever, but either name, you're going to get to us. So, and we're located at 215 Niagara Street, 716-434-7433.
Okay, I apologize. I was reading the wrong paper, and I apologize for the confusion. But back to Frank Gaffney. It was on September 29th. He was near Ronceau, I'm probably saying that wrong, in France. And he ended up finding himself alone. And this is what happened. He said, Frank Gaffney, an automatic rifleman, pushed forward alone after the other members of his squad had been killed, discovered several Germans placing a heavy machine gun in position. He killed the crew, captured the gun, bombed several dugouts, and after killing 4 more of the enemy with his pistol, held the position until the reinforcements came up, where 80 prisoners were captured. So that's what he received the Medal of Honor for his bravery and valor. 8 days later, he suffered wounds which resulted in the loss of his arm. It said that no man has performed more daring exploits or exercised a bigger influence upon those around him by the gallantry of his conduct. That was General Pershing that said that. So Frank Gaffney ended up, after the war, he did live in Lockport for a time, but then returned to Niagara Falls, and he also suffered a fall at his home in Niagara Falls, and he died on May 25th, 1948. So that's Frank Gaffney, and I apologize again for the confusion.
And there is a Gaffney Road in Lockport
named
for him.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
So...
We've talked mostly about Lockport people, but there was one man from Niagara Falls, Thomas Welch. There's a Welch Avenue in Lockport, in Niagara Falls, named for him. His home later became the Echo Club. If anybody that's familiar with Niagara Falls, it's on Portage Road, and that was a social club for many, many years, but that was actually Thomas Welch's house. But Thomas Welch was one of the promoters, a very strong promoter of Niagara Falls, and he was also one of the people that really pushed for the establishment of the Niagara Falls Reservation State Park. And he worked with Governor, at the time, Governor Grover Cleveland. He also worked with Theodore Roosevelt, who was on that same commission. He was a young assemblyman from New York City. So, I think Welch said one of his greatest achievements was the establishment of the Reservation State Park. And when President McKinley came to visit in 1901, during the time of the Pan American Exposition, and he came to Niagara Falls, it was Thomas Welch that was his host in Niagara Falls, and who took him on the tour of the Reservation State Park, and also accompanied him on the Great Gorge Railroad, and also to the Niagara Falls Power Company tour. So Welch was, as I said, he was a great promoter of Niagara Falls, also a friend to many prominent people. Back to Lockport now. I just have one more person to talk about, and that was another man who was also a prominent politician from Lockport, and his name was Richard Crowley. And Richard Crowley lived in one of the homes on High Street that later became a part of the Presbyterian home, which now, unfortunately, is closed. But Richard Crowley had served in several capacities. He was chairman of the United States House Committee on Claims during the time that he was in Congress. He served in Congress from 1879 to 1883, served two-year terms in Congress. He was also very good friends with presidents. He was a friend of President Garfield. He was a friend of President Chester Arthur. And Chester Arthur's son, Alan Arthur, was engaged to Crowley's daughter, Maud Crowley. And this is kind of tragic because they were to be married, but Maud contracted tuberculosis, consumption as it was known at that time. And she broke off the engagement because she didn't think it would be fair for her to marry Alan Arthur and then die soon after the wedding. So she broke the engagement and they did not get married. He did end up marrying someone else later on.
And she did pass away very young.
Very young, yeah. She was
I think 18.
In early, yeah, no more than 20 years old anyway. So he was also a friend of Theodore Roosevelt's as well. And when Theodore Roosevelt was governor of New York in 1889, there's a photograph of Roosevelt arriving at the train station in Newfane, and with him is Richard Crowley and Thomas Welch from Niagara Falls. So all of these men kind of were in the same circles.
Isn't that something? So, well, ladies, thank you so much for your sharing your wealth of knowledge about Niagara County and the surrounding areas. This has been a wonderful show. I learned a lot, and I'm certain that our listeners did too. I hope to see you again both in the very near future. You have about 30 seconds if you'd like to finish things up.
Okay. One thing I do want to say is that we do get a grant from New York State, from the New York State Council on the Arts, and that helps to fund part of our programming. There is a book signing for Anne Marie's book on March 23rd at 1:30 to 3. We have a program tomorrow at 2 on Lockport photographers, and we are still taking applications for interns until